Six listeners can't be wrong.
Yeah, six listeners cannot be wrong. Rob Wolf.
Andy Dees. The Paleo Solution.
Holy cow. Gads.
Rob Wolf, Andy Dees, back with episode 69, The Paleo Solution. And today we are joined by Chris Kresser. What's up, guys?
Not much. Right.
Chris, how you doing, man?
I'm good. I'm enjoying the sun again, I have to say. Spoiled Californian, but what can I do about it? It's in my blood.
Oh, dude, I will bitch at the first day of cloud in California. Like, the whole state can dry up, and we just need to, like, extract water out of the air. And
I'm with you. My wife's Canadian. She looks at me like I'm crazy when I complain after 2 days of rain. You know, she's like, what do you mean? It's barely even started.
Yeah, well, we were just talking about this before we pressed record, that the Canadians are just wired up differently, as was evidenced by Matt Lalonde last week. So
I can attest to that.
Hey, anyone that could send, you know, lists of scientific references like that, Rob, we'll have them on anytime. Anytime he wants to, you know, wants us to wake up at 6 a.m. and record conference calls, we'll do it.
That's true. That's true. We're in.
What about you guys?
We went and did a little bit of traveling and just got back, and glad that the weather's good. That's about it. Andy looks taller and swarthier than the last time I saw him. I don't know if that's possible, but...
Rob, I had a client today who have only been training for a month, two women in their 50s. She's like, did you always have a beard? And I'm like, you mean for the past month? And she's like, yeah. I'm like, do you not pay attention to at all what we do in the gym? Like, I've always had a beard.
She probably just has really bad eyesight and has only been able to focus on, like, your mid-sternum area. So. True.
She's not tall. She's concerned about us cutting out two major food groups, though. So, you know, she's the one that commented that the health of the gym was at risk because we cut out food groups.
Uh-oh.
No.
Hey, man.
Is that the Twinkie and the breakfast cereal food groups?
Right, those, yeah.
Those are my two favorite after I watch those guys on epicmealtime.com, you know, deep fry the ho-hos and ding-dongs and make that crepe.
Dude, it's genius. Chris, if we fry the gluten hot enough, it'll kill it, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right, definitely. No worries there.
Perfect, perfect.
Actually, you got to add seed. You got to use, you know, the highest omega-6 seed oil you can. I heard that works really well.
Perfect. And pump some oxygen through it with a little bit of a platinum catalyst just to make sure we hydrogenate it all.
Even better. And then, yeah, bread it in flour, of course.
Cool. I'm in.
Rob, I wanted to mention, I got a random email from a guy I went to high school with on Facebook. He's like, I started listening to your podcast, and he's like, you know, Rob's a little over your head, but you guys are really funny. So, you know,
I'm just gonna obviously keep listening. He doesn't get out much.
I know. He's an attorney, so, you know.
There you go. Yeah, he just deals with angry people all the time. So.
Exactly. So, Rob, I'm supposed to remind you that you may want to say something about Paleo Brands.
Oh, I'm not sure what to say about it. So, you know, Paleo Brands, buy some food. We have good jerky. So buy some cookies.
Performance art.
You're quite the salesperson, Rob.
Yeah, totally.
I know. We don't suck.
Paleo Brands. It doesn't suck much.
Rob, is there anything else you want to talk about before we get to Chris?
No, dude, we need to introduce Chris and actually get some qualitative content on this thing before people start tuning out.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, I thought for folks maybe that don't know Chris could give us a little bit of background, kind of his story. I know there's a lot of stuff in there about the Indonesian illness and Zen meditation, et cetera. And then, Rob, maybe you could chime in about, you know, how you bumped into Chris and, you know, kind of how we got to this point. Because all I know is I get this email like, hey, we're going to have Chris Kresser on the podcast. And I'm like, awesome. Who is Chris Kresser? I better go look.
Who the Sam Hill?
Yep.
Chris, tell all six listeners who the heck you are. And
all right.
How you the unfortunate set of circumstances that brought you to share an episode with Andy and I.
Right. All right. Well, let's see. I have a integrative medicine practice in Berkeley, and I also work with people around the world by phone and Skype. I did my training as an acupuncturist and herbalist, but I practice what I like to call investigative medicine, which means I focus on determining the underlying cause of the problem and addressing it at that level instead of just chasing after symptoms. So I specialize in working with patients who've been struggling with chronic complex illness, who haven't been able to find help anywhere else. And I do Western modern lab testing and some traditional diagnostic stuff. And then I use dietary changes, you know, paleo type of diet, plus botanical medicine, supplements, and lifestyle changes to restore function. So that's what I do. And how I came to this, well, that's a long story. But the short version is, in my early 20s, I did a lot of traveling, and I spent a lot of time in Indonesia and Southeast Asia surfing, and mostly surfing. And I was in a village on Sumbawa, and I got super sick, like, you know, the classic tropical type of illness that, you know, you hear about, with coming out of both ends and delirious, didn't remember anything, you know, for 3 days, or just completely blank. Luckily, some other guy there had some antibiotics in his kit, and, you know, who knows, I might have saved my life. And then I was fine for about 6 months after that. I was still traveling, and I just started to get sick again, and couldn't, you know, went to doctors, came back to the States, went to several different doctors. They all thought I had, you know, parasites, so they gave me Flagyl. I took the drugs, didn't, you know, would get better for a little while, then it would get worse. And, you know, this started just a long, long, several year process of trying to figure out what the heck was going on. And in that process, I just started to educate myself, because I realized that, you know, there wasn't anybody else that was more interested in me getting well than me.
Sure.
So, and I also realized that a lot of the common, you know, the sort of typical things that I had learned about health and nutrition were just flat out wrong. And so I just went back to school, studied Chinese medicine, and started doing my own research. And, you know, one thing led to another, and here I am.
Nice. And I think I was introduced to Chris via Diane Sanfilippo, who Balanced Bites. And I think she went to one of your talks. Is that the first time you guys met, or?
I don't think she's been to a talk. I don't actually remember where we met, but we've seen each other at a couple of Dr. Karazian's lectures.
Gotcha. Okay.
And, you know, we just hooked up, you know, sending emails back and forth, just talking about gluten and, you know, dorking out on all this stuff like we do.
Right.
So, and yeah, we got together over here. We had some tea together and just got to know each other, which is great. She's fantastic.
Yeah. Diane's awesome. She's totally a badass in this whole thing. And I think Chris, our first phone call was about 2.5 hours or something like that. So hit it off pretty good right off the bat. So super stoked that finally got to meet you, got you on the podcast and everything. And now you have your own podcast rolling now.
I did like a couple of them about a year ago, and then I was just too busy with finishing school, and so it kind of lagged in the background for a while. And then we just did our first episode. We recorded another, so it's going to be pretty regular twice a month, I think, for a while. We'll see how that goes.
Where can people track that down?
That's at thehealthyskeptic.org, which is my blog. And just click on the podcast button in the navigation bar. It's also on iTunes, if you're an iTunes subscriber.
Cool. So yeah. Obviously an opportunity to listen to something much better quality than this.
I don't know about that. Hey, Rob, I gotta tell you, my wife's pretty happy that we've met, because she's getting tired of me talking about gluten for 2 hours.
And I'm not sure how meeting me will mitigate that, when I'm pestering you like constantly with like, Chris, do you have this paper? Have you read this thing? And
the point is, I'm not talking to her about it as much anymore.
Kind of like finding a kid down the street who has
that's
a
right.
sickle that you have. It's that's like, right. Hey, cool.
All right, so we should get to it before people get angry with us.
Well, huh? I want to know about your Zen meditation practice.
Okay.
Because that's something that I would geek out on talking about.
All right. I actually got introduced to meditation by my dad, which is not the normal route, I guess. But he was doing it for stress reduction mostly when I was about 17. He turned me on to it. That wasn't Zen at the time. It was transcendental meditation. I don't know if you guys have heard of that. That's a whole other story. But it was a starting place for me, and it was good. I got to experience the benefits of meditation practice, and then got involved in Zen practice, and have been a formal student of Zen for the past several years. Actually, my teacher, Darlene Cohen, just passed away a few weeks ago. So that's a big change for me. But it's been a big part of my life and a big part of my healing process, a big part of the way that I worked with chronic illness myself, and a big part of how I work with patients. So mostly for me, it boils down to learning to stay present with whatever's happening without too much reactivity. And that can be a pretty important skill when you're dealing with some heavy physiological or even emotional or psychological symptoms.
Art Devaney had some really nice writings on kind of a Zen approach, in an interesting wedding of kind of the Zen philosophy and paleo evolutionary biology type concepts. So it's an interesting thing. You see a lot of that same kind of flavor floating around, like people seem to aggregate with these different concepts. So it's mm-hmm. pretty cool.
Yeah, I should check that out. I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
Plus, he's taller than you, Rob. So we know he's
dude. Everybody's taller than I am. I'm like Hervé Villechaize. So.
Somebody sent me an email, Rob, totally off the subject, that Wellborn should come back on, or all our guests, and we should just spend an hour making fun of you. Apparently, that's a very popular topic.
I'm an easy target, so.
So, Chris, next time you're on, you can think of some jokes at Rob's expense, and then we'll, you've been warned. We're prepared.
All right, got it.
So what we did for Chris is we took a number of the questions and kind of summarized them and abstract them a little bit just to talk about some key topics. So one of the ones I thought we would start with, and I'm going a little out of order because I've had some decaf tea, so I'm fired up. We're going to start with dairy because, Chris, from my quick looking at your stuff and some of Rob's comments in the past, I think there may be a little bit of some discrepancies on your opinions on dairy and how it should be used in a healthy diet. Mm-hmm. And part of the things we like to do is certainly get some opposing opinions on here because it helps us learn and grow, and healthy discourse and debate is always a good thing in our minds. So you wanted to give us a quick 20,000-foot view of your opinions on dairy, and then we can kind of drill down from there.
Yeah, sure. I think dairy is a highly individual issue, so I try to stay away from making any blanket statements because it really does boil down to individual tolerance. With that in mind, I think dairy, and particularly raw dairy products, can be a really healthy food when they're well tolerated in the absence of any leaky gut or cross-reactivity. There's a lot of traditional cultures that thrived on dairy, some of them that Weston Price studied, like the Swiss and the Maasai. In fact, some of those cultures lived almost entirely on grass-fed dairy. The Maasai ate, their diet basically consists of meat, milk, and blood, and they're exceptionally healthy. And then you have the Lochinthal Swiss, who ate mostly pastured dairy products, especially at the times of the year where they couldn't eat any plant foods. So that said, I'll be the first to say that dairy protein is one of the first things that people cross-react to when they're gluten intolerant, and that for anybody who has a leaky gut, dairy proteins are going to be potentially problematic because if they get through the gut lining into the bloodstream, they're going to cause an immune reaction. So for me, working with patients, I usually, if anyone's got a leaky gut or chronic inflammatory condition, I usually have them remove it until we can restore their intestinal barrier integrity. But once we do that, then I like to start to gradually add dairy back in, starting with the highest fat, lowest lactose dairy products like ghee and butter, and then moving through the spectrum to the products that contain more lactose. I I generally think that pasteurized non-fermented dairy, just like straight up pasteurized milk, is not really a good food for anybody, because I look at it more as a processed food than a whole food. Raw milk has lactose, but it also has lactase, which is the enzyme that's required, of course, to break down lactose. But pasteurization kills lactase, and so you only get the lactose and not the lactase, and then none of the beneficial bacteria that are in raw milk either. So you sort of take out most of the good stuff and leave the stuff that's potentially problematic. So I'm not a fan of pasteurized milk. I think yogurt and kefir and fermented dairy products made from pasteurized milk can be okay, because they of course then have the bacteria, and then a lot of the lactose has been broken down during the fermentation process. So that's my, maybe that's a little lower than 20,000 feet, but that's my spiel on dairy.
You know, and it's funny, like several folks, and I think there's a couple of different topics on here where they were like, well, you and Rob disagree on this, that, and the other, but there's nothing that I would disagree with any of that. My position on dairy has always been it's a potential problem, kind of a gray area kind of item. Pull it out, get healthy, reverse dysbiosis, make sure your vitamin D levels are good, and then reintroduce and just kind of check your temperature and see how you do with it, and then kind of roll from there. You know, Professor Cordain has had some misgivings about some potential problems with like the IGF activation, some potential problems with cancer down the road with dairy. Chris, can you, I mean, from this is kind of drawing back into that epidemiological / anthropological type stuff. We just don't really see anything like that in these dairying cultures, you know,
exactly.
like the Maasai and whatnot. And so it starts sounding a whole lot like when we talk about animal proteins causing cancer, and then we throw out examples like the Aceh Indians of Peru or the Inuit, where they're eating about a 90% animal product diet and they're experiencing no cancer. But is there any thought to that? Do you think some of the processing might be an issue there, or where might there be some?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly possible that it's not only possible, it's actual that pasteurized dairy has a different effect on the body, as I was just explaining. And certainly the Maasai weren't pasteurizing their milk. And, you know, none of these traditional cultures were. So that's a possibility. I think I agree completely with what you were saying about the difficulty in isolated nutrient studies, because, I mean, we know very well what the risks are with that. Like, look at T. Colin Campbell and his studies that show that casein causes cancer. Well, that's interesting, but what he neglected to mention was that whey is anti-carcinogenic. And, you know, casein doesn't really appear without whey in foods. So if you just look at the isolated nutrients, you often miss the whole picture. And that's just a good example. And from my research, I haven't seen any actual human studies that show anything but benefit over a long period of time with full-fat dairy consumption. Now, low-fat or non-fat dairy is problematic, because we need fat to absorb protein, particularly vitamin A, fat-soluble vitamins like vitamin A. And if you're eating or drinking a lot of skim milk and eating a lot of super lean proteins without enough fat in the diet, then you'll pull the fat-soluble vitamins out of the liver and end up being deficient in those fat-soluble vitamins, which, as I think most people know now, is a really bad idea.
Sure. Chris, did you know, I sent you this paper maybe 2 hours ago, so I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, but a friend of mine, Mike Malloy, shot me a paper looking at some gut permeability issues and actually relating it back to actually retinoic acid, vitamin A. Did you get a chance to look at that yet?
No, I was seeing patients this morning. I just
Damn
got
you.
Home.
Yeah, Damn
sorry
you
about that.
Schedule. Well, maybe we'll pull you back on the show later.
Yeah.
We can talk about that.
Let's talk about it, yeah.
Andy, do you think that's a thorough enough accounting of dairy? You got anything else we can...
Well, can I in California get raw milk?
You can. You can. California is one of the few states that permits it. Whole Foods used to carry it, but they sold out, so they're not carrying it anymore. There are Sorry, I have a little bone to pick with Whole Foods and their vegan agenda.
I was just going to mention that.
We'll talk about that another time. But they used to carry it. They're not anymore because of supposed liability concerns, even though there's been a lot more cases of foodborne illness with pasteurized dairy than there has been with raw dairy. It's way, way more. I don't know what, you know, up there what your health food store scene is like, but down here there are, you know, several stores that carry it. Organic Pastures is one brand, and Clairvale is the other.
And I think some states it just needs to be labeled not fit for human consumption pet only, and so it's kind
I'm
of a
getting it for my pet.
Deal.
Yeah, the code word. And then in other states. And in all states, actually, you can do something called a cow share, where you basically buy a share, a part of a cow, more or less, and that entitles you to drink the milk, because they're not selling the milk to you. You're actually part owner of the cow. So they kind of skirt the legal issue there. So you can sometimes contact farmers in your local area and do it that way, and it's usually cheaper that way anyways.
Cool.
I bought some raw milk when I was in Indiana, and I noticed that nice label, you know, not safe for human consumption.
Yeah, they like to scare the heck out of you. Of course, they don't put that on the loaf of bread that's sitting right next to
me. Yeah, or the Mountain Dew with the high fructose corn syrup. Awesome.
Yeah. This was at a nice, very nice kind of farmer's market that also served wine, so you could drink and shop for your farm.
Nice.
It was really nice. Very nice outside, kind of a rustic location. I was thinking on your whole Whole Foods and their vegan propaganda. I don't know that if you've heard about this, but my brother's girlfriend works for some of the Wynn properties in Vegas, you know, Steve Wynn, and he has provided free of charge to all the employees these wonderful DVDs with some great vegan propaganda.
Oh, boy, brainwashing.
You just show up at work and learn about how to eat healthy and safely and live longer.
Vegan? Is that like the vegan buffet in Vegas? I haven't seen that one yet.
Well, in all the Wynn properties, they've gone back and now added vegan entrees for Steve and his employees to eat healthily.
Right.
They must have clove cigarettes of it, too.
Yeah, and seitan, you know, the really healthy gluten-processed fake meat. Yum.
The rise of the vegan powers. Watch out.
Hey, Rob, I hope we're not disappointing people. I think they wanted us to get a little bit Jerry Springer on the dairy and fish oil issue. I guess, you know, there's still a chance with fish oil. We'll see.
we'll see if we can drum up some controversy. Yeah. But it's just funny. This is almost exactly like the fish oil calculator that Dallas and Melissa have on their website, which says if you're overweight, sick, inflamed, use a lot for a period of time, then dial back. But you know, it seems like nobody seems to read that. But maybe we can drum up some controversy.
Yeah.
Should we talk about fish oil next?
That's a good segue. Okay. 20,000 view.
You can just go whatever view you want to go with.
All right.
I'm not even going to estimate anymore. And I think people like details. That's why Rob has a podcast. He's not Dr. Oz. You know, we're going to go with the details.
Okay, details it is. The first thing I'll say is that my view on fish oil has evolved over time, and as I learn more, I hope to continue to evolve my opinions. If I don't, I'll be in big trouble.
That's crazy talk.
Yeah. Sorry. From what I've learned, you know, and I've done a lot of research on this topic. It's one of the things I have looked into probably more than any other issue on my blog. Other than heart disease, but they're obviously related. I think the benefits of fish oil supplementation have been pretty overstated. Most of the studies that show benefits are short-term. They generally last less than 1 year. Even those don't necessarily show the benefit that most people think. The Cochrane group did an analysis, a meta-analysis on almost 80 trials lasting more than 6 months. And the only statistically significant effect they were able to find was a reduced risk of heart failure. But there was no reduction in cardiovascular and total mortality. And one of the things that worries me the most is that the only fish oil study lasting more than 4 years, which is the DART2 trial, showed an increase in heart disease and sudden death. So of course the question is why and how could this happen? Well, if you understand the structure of fats, fish oil is a polyunsaturated fat, omega-3 polyunsaturated fat, which is the most unstable and the most vulnerable to oxidative damage of any fat, even more unstable than the dreaded omega-6 polyunsaturated fat. And what we know is that when fat particles oxidize, they break down into smaller compounds like MDA. And MDA is dangerous because it can damage proteins and DNA and other cellular structures. And in fact, studies do show that oxidative damage by compounds like MDA increases as the intake of omega-3 fat increases. So, for example, I think one study found that six grams of fish oil per day, which is not a huge dose, but it's, you know, more than a maintenance dose, increases lipid peroxides and MDA, regardless of whether those people supplemented with vitamin E or not. So, you know, to be fair, some shorter-term trials have shown a benefit, like the GISI and DART1 trial found that fish oil can prevent arrhythmia in patients with chronic heart failure and a recent heart attack. But there's really not much evidence that people other than those with chronic heart failure and arrhythmia benefit, and there's no evidence that higher doses above 1 gram provide a benefit over smaller doses and, over the long term. And it's, you know, it's logical to assume that the effects of oxidative damage would take a while to manifest and actually that they would increase as time goes on, which is probably why we see a benefit in the short-term studies as the omega-3 displaces the omega-6 in the tissue. But then the benefit declines and even turns to harm in the longer-term studies as the oxidative damage increases. So I basically... my thing with the balancing the omega-6-3 ratio is to just dramatically decrease omega-6 as much as you possibly can, and then, you know, eat fish 3 times a week, fatty fish, 6 ounces, you know, three times a week, and maybe take some fermented cod liver oil, which we can generate some controversy with that one too, probably, Rob. And then, you know, if you do that and your intake of nuts and dark meat poultry is, you know, moderate, and you're not eating any seed oil, or, you know, it's pretty, you can do it. You know, you can have a 2-to-1 or a 1-to-1 omega-6-to-3 ratio. So I'm in favor of doing that rather than big doses of fish oil because of the danger of oxidative damage.
Now, what about somebody coming on the scene, like they roll in as a client and lots of systemic inflammation, pretty overweight, maybe like some depression, you know, just kind of classic metabolic syndrome, classic systemic inflammation. This is where my thought, and this is based in part off of a couple of papers. One of them is this glucose hysteresis paper, which is talking about gene expression and the totality of gene expression kind of having like a drift, you know, if you imagine like a big super tanker or like a ship like the Titanic, the genetic expression starts getting kind of almost momentum or kind of an inertia to it. Mm-hmm. And in order to flip things around, sometimes you need a pretty dramatic input. And so that was some of the thought, and the authors of that paper were actually talking about omega-3s as a means of kind of writing course on that ship gone awry. And so for a long time, I was kind of thinking that, you know, generally higher intake of omega-3s would be beneficial, and then started reevaluating that. And so I guess where I'm at right now is that if the individual is sick, inflamed, has some problems, do that rather large dose of fish oil to right the ship, but then the rest of the dietary and lifestyle factors should fall into place such that it is essentially what you're describing, like a low linoleic acid intake, the short chain omega-6 intake, everything else should follow into place. And that I think for a long time the thought was that large amounts of omega-3s could simply counterbalance omega-6 or could undo systemic inflammation, which I think we're pretty sure that that's inaccurate at this point. But what do you think about that short-term punctuated use, or would you prefer just dial down the omega-6s and tackle it that way.
That's my preference, but I can see the logic behind that. And, you know, I just want to remind people that we're talking about the last 10% here, probably. You know, like, what I mean by that is, I don't think that taking high doses of fish oil for a short period of time, like a month or 6 weeks, is going to have a serious lasting negative consequence. So,
but you're also not sold that it has significant benefit.
I'm not sold. I'm not sold that it doesn't. So I'm trying to keep an open mind on that. But I can just tell you that my preference in terms of working with patients is, you know, what I said, just to really dramatically, because I think dramatically lowering N6, the omega-6 is going to have, it alters the tissue. It's going to alter the tissue ratio in a similar way. The problem, though, is that not as you probably, you know, as I'm sure you've encountered, is not everybody's either willing to do that so quickly right off the bat. So if some, you know, if somebody is at, I just try to kind of work with people where they're at. I'm a little bit of a hard ass. I mean, if people aren't willing to make the changes that I'm suggesting, they usually don't stick around for that long,
right?
Because it's just, that's what I have to offer, you know. But at the same time, I understand that, you know, they're huge changes, and they're really, you know, have a huge effect on our life. It's sometimes difficult for us, you know, who've been living this lifestyle for a while, to remember how significant those changes are. But I'd say in general, I'm in favor of just cranking the omega-6 as low as possible, and then eating fish. And I'd feel more comfortable about people, you know, bringing in more omega-3s just by, like, eating fish more regularly than I would from them taking huge doses of fish oil.
That's cool. Yeah.
So, Chris, just because we have a fairly broad audience of folks, I'd be curious if you would share, you know, you mentioned one thing about nut intake, you know, the ways that you see are the most important to help limit your omega-6 intake.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, all the seed oils are just right out. And I don't think anybody who's following a paleo diet is eating those, so we won't spend too much time on that. But, you know, all the omega-6 seed oils, like cottonseed, corn, soybean, etc., those things, they're in packaged foods a lot too. So even the so-called organic, healthy, quote, packaged foods, you got to look out for them. But one of the surprise things for people to learn is how much omega-6 nuts have. Most nuts, at least, and poultry. Dark meat poultry with the skin on it has about 16 to 18 times more omega-6 than even grain-fed beef, which is pretty significant. You know, it's pretty dramatic. I forget the actual number from the you know, grams, but it's high. It's higher than you would think. And then, you know, even if you eat just like 100 grams of walnuts a day, which is kind of a lot, but it's not beyond what I've seen people, you know, some of my patients come in with, you would be consuming about 265 grams of linoleic acid a week, just 100 grams of walnuts a day. To give you an idea of how much fish you'd need to eat to have an even ratio of omega-6 to omega-3, it'd be 34 pounds of salmon. So it's, you know, it's real. It's like the nuts, they've got a lot of omega-6, and they're certainly healthy. There's a lot of healthy things about nuts. But I don't think from evolutionary perspective, we were chowing down, you know, several handfuls of nuts a day. And I think that the omega-6 burden of that can be pretty significant.
Almost impossible to get out from under.
Impossible. Yeah. Nobody's going to eat 34 pounds of those. It's impossible unless you're taking, you know, 15 or 20 grams of fish oil a day, which, again, I would just rather see people eat less nuts.
Right.
Yeah. And poultry was kind of the biggest surprise, I think, for most people, especially like with the skin, and, you know, because usually we're teaching people not to be afraid of fat. But then, you know, when I'm warning people, okay, don't be afraid of fat, of saturated fat, you know, especially, but you might want to put the brakes on with the dark meat poultry and the skin and just, you know, have it a couple times a week instead of making that your main, you know, animal protein source.
So this may be outside the scope, but do you know if that's a result of some different feed that goes to the critters, or do the birds preferentially store omega-6s in the dark meat areas?
Yeah,
is
I think
it mainly arachidonic acid, or is it linoleic acid, or?
I think it's a little of both. And mm-hmm. you know, to answer your questions, I mean, certainly chickens that are grass, you know, pasture raised, and they're eating worms and grubs and K1 in the grass and things like that, they're going to have a better or more favorable fatty acid profile. I've been looking for studies that compare the fatty acid profile in the meat of pasture raised chickens versus the meat of grain fed chickens. I haven't been able to find any. So if anybody out there knows of some, send them our way. That would be great. Mm-hmm. I have seen several studies comparing the omega-6 content of battery chickens versus pasture-raised chickens, and there's significantly more omega-6 in their eggs. So I think it stands to reason that there'd be significantly more omega-6 in their flesh as well.
Sure.
So it does matter, pastured versus you know, battery-raised, but still, I think even a pasture-raised chicken, they're still eating grain. For example, we have chickens in our backyard, and they need some kind of grain to flourish and to lay well. And so we were looking, you know, we set out to find some soy-free, corn-free feed, figuring that that would significantly lower their, you know, the omega-6 ratio in the eggs. And it was almost impossible to find. We ended up, I mean, we literally order feed from a farmer in Washington. That's the closest place that we could find that makes a soy-free, corn-free feed. So I think even pasture-raised chickens are eating a lot of corn and soy, and that's bound to raise the omega-6. So again, I don't want to tell people, I'm not saying don't eat chicken. I'm just saying, you know, don't make it the staple meat, you know?
So to follow up on that, don't make it staple meat. Since Matt Lalonde started the ritual of giving an example day's food, Chris, what did mm-hmm. you eat today?
Okay, let's see. So I had two eggs from our backyard girls, couple pieces of bacon, which Diane will be happy to hear, half a sweet potato with about 2 or 3 tablespoons of grass-fed butter, and some raw kimchi, which is like a, you know, fermented vegetables, for those of you who don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. For lunch, I had some grass-fed ground beef I made with Indian spices, like keema. It's kind of the name of the recipe, with some, I've been on a kick lately for, you know, anyone who's seen my Facebook page, I take pictures of my meals sometimes. I've been making these taro chips. So I get taro and slice it pretty thin, and then I roast them in lard or duck fat and with some salt and pepper. They're so good. So I had some taro chips and then a green salad with olive oil and vinegar. That's it so far.
Nice.
I like it. Cool.
Yeah.
I'm glad I
hadn't stopped at McDonald's on the way home.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know if you listened to the episode or Matt Lalonde went into talking about how much he eats, which, you know, takes a full hour to consume. It's like a pound and a half of grass-fed beef with, you know, enough vegetables to kill a small animal, you know.
Yeah.
That's his post-workout meal. So
right.
He's,
yeah. Yeah. I eat a little more on the workout days, but today's been pretty sedentary.
Since you mentioned kind of the sweet potato thing, I know there's this question about kind of safe starches and also about intermittent fasting. So you want to give give your thoughts on kind of safe starches, and then also we'll head to the magical intermittent fasting.
Yeah, safe starches, I love them. That's the, I mean, I think they're great. I think they're a great source of glucose and you know, healthy carbohydrate that the body can easily absorb and make use of. I personally eat, a pretty fair amount. I'm not a low carber myself. I probably eat about 100 grams. I guess some people would consider that low carb. I consider it to be moderate, 100 maybe to 125. I find that I just start losing weight if I eat less than that, no matter how much fat and protein I eat. So I eat a lot of yams, taro, lotus. Lotus is a good one. Not many people are aware of that. It's a good safe starch. Green plantains are good. Kind of a savory taste, not very sweet. And then yuca. Yuca is another favorite. I like to make mashed yuca. It's got a good substitute for mashed potatoes. You can also make yuca fries.
Yes, that's excellent.
Yeah. So I think safe starch is great. I generally suggest around 100 grams a day as an average carb intake. I see a lot of patients come in. I just talked to one this morning who are on extremely low carb diets or even zero carb diets, and they're not losing weight. In fact, sometimes they're even gaining weight, and they're intermittent fasting, and they can't really figure out what's going on. And when I have them start to add a little bit more carbohydrate in, which makes, it's like totally counterintuitive in terms of what we all, what you might think in terms of weight loss, they actually start losing weight again. And then in terms of intermittent fasting, it's a similar thing. I think intermittent fasting from an evolutionary perspective is right on. I mean, it's very almost certain that that was the norm, for most of human history. And that we're programmed to do well without eating for certain periods of time, and it can stimulate autophagy and, cellular cleanup process and stuff like that. But I also know that, most of us are pretty far outside of the evolutionary norm at this point, with the traffic and, late night Facebook and environmental toxins and the just crazy amounts of stress that people are under takes its toll on the adrenals, and fasting can be a stress on the adrenals. If blood sugar gets low, cortisol will kick, adrenals will secrete cortisol to bring it back up. And that, process over a long period of time can deplete cortisol levels, or it can dysregulate the cortisol, melatonin rhythm. And so if someone has a, basically healthy metabolism, and intermittent fasting seems to work really well. Some of my patients come in and their metabolism's all screwed up, and they're intermittent fasting and they're getting worse. And I know some people believe that if you just continue with the intermittent fasting, that eventually it will, things will improve and even out. And maybe that's true.
I think sometimes you call that death.
Right. I'm open to the possibility that in some cases that would happen, but I just see people getting worse. And so I actually will have them go to almost to the other extreme and eat every 2 to 3 hours. I know that's kind of sacrilege, like in the Martin, in the lean gains world. But it works. These people start to lose weight, their blood sugar normalizes. And I know that because I'm having them test with the glucometer. So we've got evidence of it. Their symptoms of blood sugar dysregulation disappear and they feel better. So it's just something to be aware of. I like intermittent fasting. I do it myself about 2 to 3 days a week. But I don't recommend it for someone who's got, metabolic problems.
So you're saying this is not a one-size-fits-all scenario?
Yep, that's
what I'm saying. Damn you.
Damn. Yeah, it rarely is, which, we always want it to be that way, but it almost never is, at least in my world.
It never is in any world, Chris.
Well, it actually is in some people's world, Andy. That's the problem.
But that's not reality.
Right.
It was funny, is that there's this question on here about constipation on a paleo diet, and you'd mentioned it's a common problem, and I was having this discussion with one of the local docs in town, trains at our gym. He's like, I was at this lecture and people were asking about constipation and paleo diet. And he was like, I don't even know how that's possible. And I was like, well, you know, I kind of went into it a little bit. So maybe you can talk a little bit about why you think this is a common problem and then, you know, things sure. that you generally recommend to help resolve that.
Yeah. I think constipation, I mean, there's several different causes, of course, but one of the main causes that's not often talked about is that 70 to 80% of the dry weight of stool is bacteria, which is, you know, lovely to think about, but that's what it is. It's mostly bacteria. So if you don't have enough good bacteria in your gut, you're not going to have regular stools. So this is the whole thing about fiber. A lot of people think that the benefit of fiber is that it's kind of like a mechanical effect where it pushes the stool through and you know stimulates motility, etc. And it does have some mechanical effect, but the real benefit of fiber comes with soluble fiber because it feeds the beneficial bacteria in the distal colon. We can't digest it, so it goes all the way through to our colon, and that becomes food for the bacteria there, and they produce short-chain fatty acids like butyrate and propionate and acetate, and those short-chain fatty acids are the fuel for colonocytes, the cells in the colon. So I think what probably happens for a lot of people who were on a grain, you know, a diet with a lot of insoluble fiber that has that kind of mechanical effect, and they switch to a paleo diet, which tends to be, it doesn't have any grain fiber in it at all, and tends to be generally lower in fiber, especially if they're switching to a low carb paleo diet where they're not eating the sweet potatoes and say starches, which have the soluble fiber. They go from having, you know, that mechanical effect and then the benefit of the soluble fiber to not having much of that at all. And so that's probably where the constipation comes from, I think. The solution to that is making sure that they've got enough good gut flora, and that generally means eating more safe starches and things like sweet potatoes, leeks, all of the starches that I mentioned before. And if that doesn't work, or if they can't tolerate a lot of starches because of blood sugar issues, then I will use probiotics and prebiotics, which is basically the same concept as the fiber. Prebiotics are indigestible carbohydrates that feed the bacteria, especially bifidobacter. So we'll do that. We'll add, try to have them increase their fermented food intake, like sauerkraut or kimchi or any fermented vegetables or fermented dairy if they tolerate it well. The other thing is magnesium and potassium. Potassium is needed for motility, and magnesium can help bring some water into the colon and help with motility as well. It's also a smooth muscle relaxant, so it can give a little boost that way. So some combination of magnesium, potassium, if they're deficient in potassium, and then the sweet potatoes, safe starches, and prebiotics and probiotics almost always does the trick. And if it doesn't, it's usually a sign that there's something else there that needs to be investigated.
Chris, do you ever see a situation in which actually the removal of some gut irritants like gluten or some other grain items may actually be part of the constipation, at least initially?
You mean like if the gut irritants were promoting hypermotility?
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah, it's sort of, in a sense, they probably would have been constipated anyways, right? But they were eating these irritants that increased their motility, not necessarily in a beneficial, in a healthy physiological way, but it had kind of, kept them going at least.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's legit.
Andy, any more questions on poop?
No, I feel like I'm talking to Garrett Smith right now. I'm
on everybody's favorite subject. I think another thing, I mean, this might go without saying, but if there's a leaky gut, that's got to be fixed, because a leaky gut's going to cause inflammation, and inflammation will impair motility and also dysregulate the gut flora. So I would say if somebody's doing everything that we just talked about and they're still constipated, it's probably a good idea to do some testing and kind of get under the hood a little bit, see what's going on.
I know we had talked before that there was some kind of exciting research related to leaky gut, especially gluten intolerance, and so we maybe want to spend a few minutes touching on that, because I think I'm really excited about this. So I'm sure everyone is. Then.
Oh yeah, this is like a hot topic on the street.
Well, about a 98.6 topic, or 37 Celsius, but
it's. I get home from these seminars and my wife's just looking at me and shaking her head like, how can you get so excited about gluten intolerance or leaky gut? But I do. Let's see here. Yeah,
Chris, you don't need to hide anymore. You're with us, man. You're with safe people now.
I'm safe, man. All right. I think leaky gut is, if we're going to have like a pathology of the 21st century, it's leaky gut. I think antibiotics were kind of the medicine of the 20th century, for better or for worse. And probiotics, or at least figuring out how to fix the gut, is going to be the focus of this next period of time. Because what we're seeing now is that leaky gut is way more common than we thought. It's no longer this kind of freaky, weird alternative diagnosis that only, quack practitioners make. It's totally mainstream. If you look on PubMed, there's like, and search for intestinal permeability, which is the medical term for it, you'll see about 9,000 papers come up, 9,000 results. You have, big time researchers like Alessio Fasano, who've pretty much built their last 10 or 15 years of their career on it. And so, here's a few things that we know. There's basically three things that can destroy the gut lining. You can have a total destruction of the cell, which is called, that's transcellular intestinal permeability. Then you can have a loosening of the junctures of the gut lining, or the tight junctions. That's paracellular. And then you can have bacterial infection. Those are three things that will destroy the gut lining. So in terms of the bacterial infection, what happens there is a lipopolysaccharide, or LPS, which is an endotoxin that's found in the outer membrane of gram-negative bacteria, can provoke a really strong immune response. With the tight junctions, you've got proteins like occludin and claudin that kind of form, that are, main players in forming the tight junctions. And then you've got a protein called zonulin, which I know you guys have talked about before, which is, you can kind of think about it as like a traffic conductor or gatekeeper, or maybe like a doorman at a bar or something like that. Zonulin basically is responsible for deciding what gets in the bloodstream and what stays out. It's a pretty important role. And so what happens is that when things go wrong with zonulin, and what might go wrong is that if you eat gluten, for example, we know that gliadin, one of the proteins in wheat, upregulates zonulin production, and that causes basically the cells, the spaces between the cells to open up, and then the gut becomes permeable, which allows nutrients to pass through, which allows harmful bacteria and toxins to pass through above and beyond the nutrients that we want to. But one of the interesting things about leaky gut is that the research now shows that the majority of people with leaky gut don't even have gut symptoms. So this is really interesting. They'll have like skin issues like psoriasis and eczema, or they'll have depression or cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or other kind of neurodegenerative conditions. They might have joint problems. And of course, this is all the stuff that you guys are talking about every day, but we're just starting to understand the mechanisms for it in a much deeper way. I guess the last thing to say about it is that we know that zonulin, which is, as I just explained, is involved in making sure that the gut barrier is solid, is also involved in regulating the blood-brain barrier. So when you have upregulated zonulin from eating gliadin, or, you know, there's other things that can do it too, not only will you have a leaky gut, you're going to have a leaky brain. So this is why you see a lot of brain and psychological and emotional symptoms that go right along with gut symptoms, or even are present without gut symptoms in people with gluten intolerance. So, you know, it's nothing new necessarily from a perspective of how you actually live and eat, but for those of us who are into the science, and it's a really interesting that we can now explain how all this stuff works, and we can walk into a room with doctors and researchers and say it and be able to back it up completely with peer-reviewed research. So it's gonna make this stuff mainstream, and actually the main thing that's going to make this mainstream is that there is a drug company now developing a leaky gut drug. I don't know if I did I tell you that, Rob?
I was reading an article on it just this morning, actually. Yeah,
isn't that scary?
Yeah.
So they basically, what the drug does is it downregulates zonulin. So, and it's been shown in animal studies to reduce intestinal inflammation and actually reduce leaky gut in animals. But of course, we don't know what other proteins it might be downregulating and what other effects that it's going to have as far as that goes. The other way that drug companies are screwing with zonulin is they're actually using zonulin as a way, as a drug delivery method, with the idea that if they give you a leaky gut with zonulin, you're going to absorb the drug better.
Which is the deal with adjuvants in orally administrated vaccines.
Exactly.
But yeah, there's a hell of a problem with that.
Yeah, I don't even know where to start, but they're doing it with insulin.
Yeah.
So, but once it, you know, once a drug company gets its teeth in something, that now of course, like, you're going to start hearing all about leaky gut, and the it's going to be, you know, pharmaceutical sales brochures, and all the, you know, as I said on my other podcast, all the farm sales reps are going to be getting in their Ford Tauruses and driving around and telling all the doctors about leaky gut. There's a drug for it now, so it's going to be front and center.
Which is scary on the one hand, but it also legitimizes the lunatic fringe element of this too. So
that's right.
There might be some opportunity there.
Yeah, I think it'll be positive overall.
Yeah.
So we're getting close to the end of the hour. Somebody has to go back to work, but I know we talked about something earlier that may have some disagreements. Cod liver oil.
Chris,
I know you mentioned that you are sort of a fan of fermented cod liver oil.
I asked Matt Lalonde this one, and I haven't really been able to track it down. What is the benefit of fermented cod liver oil, and what exactly is getting fermented?
Yeah. Fermentation is just the way that they process it. So normally the way that cod liver oil and most fish oils really are processed is that they will use heat to basically remove the smell. Mm-hmm. They take out the vitamins. I'm getting a little feedback here. Can you guys hear me?
You're good on our side. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
I'm
hearing my voice three times in my ear, so I'm a little distracted here. I'm going to take off my headset. So in the processing of it, they use heat, and they usually will end up pulling out the naturally occurring vitamins, and then when they put them back in, almost all companies put synthetic vitamins back in. Most people don't enjoy the smell or taste of cod liver oil, so they do what they can to make it more palatable. And that process usually involves heat, and of course, heat's no good with highly fragile polyunsaturated fats that are present in cod liver oil. So there's one company, Green Pasture, that uses the traditional method of processing cod liver oil, which is fermentation. And this is something that, you know, makes it last longer, and also changes the assimilability and structure of it. But the best benefit of fermentation versus the heat is that it allows, you know, first of all, it's the peroxides are a lot lower because it's not, they're not applying heat to the fragile oil. And second of all, they leave the naturally occurring vitamins in it. So it's, you're getting the naturally occurring vitamin A and vitamin D and the vitamin E and quinones instead of something synthetic added back in. So that's the deal with fermented. In terms of cod liver oil, you know, the main objection, of course, is that vitamin A is toxic in high doses. It's definitely true that vitamin A has the potential to be toxic in high doses, but what the research suggests is that that's only true in the back, against the backdrop of vitamin D deficiency. And they've done studies where people who are supplementing with vitamin D, like the average hypothetical, you know, 160-pound person, they're supplementing with vitamin D, that will raise the toxicity threshold of A to over 200,000 IU a day, which is almost impossible to get that much. I mean, 3 ounces of beef liver has about 25,000 IU per day, and I don't know anybody who's eating
30 ounces
of beef liver. But I think a lot of people are deficient in vitamin D. I mean, 50% of Americans from when I last checked. So for the average person to, you know, to give them a lot of vitamin A without making sure that they have vitamin, you know, getting enough vitamin D, that's probably a bad idea. That's, again, another reason that I like cod liver oil as a fat-soluble vitamin supplement is that it has both D and A in it in a naturally occurring ratio. So it's way less likely that you're going to develop any toxicity from A if you're taking cod liver oil than if you were taking, you know, some kind of synthetic A supplement or just eating organ meats, which tend to be not very high in vitamin D.
Do you like Carlson cod liver oil? That's been kind of a favorite of mine. Like, have you followed their stuff at all?
Yeah, I'm the only company that I know of that does the fermentation and doesn't heat process is Green Pasture.
Cool.
And I have no affiliation with them whatsoever. I just use their product and recommend it because it's, from my estimation, the best one available. It's kind of inconvenient because you have to order it online, but it's, you know, from my research, it's by far the best one out there. So that's generally what I recommend.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, Chris, anything else you want to say before we wrap this up? And we will definitely have to have you back, and we'll have a gauntlet, maybe you versus Matt Lalonde versus Rob. And
it'll be like Godzilla versus...
Maybe we can get a set and start throwing chairs at each other or something.
Perfect.
Like that.
Poor Kurt Harris will get wrapped into this too. We'll just bring everyone we can find.
Yeah, I'm a lover. I'm a lover, not a fighter, Andy.
Anything else you want us to know
before
you go?
I had a great time. It was good time talking to you guys. And
so, first, remind everybody about your website.
It's thehealthyskeptic.org, and you know, lots of articles there, podcasts, and other fun stuff. So come check it out if you haven't already. Rob, Andy, thanks a lot for the opportunity. It was great fun.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
All right
thank guys. With that is the end of episode 69, and you guys have a great day. I'll talk to you next week.
Later, guys.
Yep.
See ya.